The following interview was conducted by Margaret Moen, assistant editor of The Wanderer, America's oldest national Catholic weekly newspaper, and Nevada Senate candidate Sharon Engel. There's a good chance that Sharon could unseat Harry Reid's Senate position this November. She needs your help. If you'd like to support Sharon, you may do so at SharonEngel.com. The following interview took place on August 30th, 2010.
Mrs. Engel, our readers will want to hear about all your stands, but I think they'll be especially interested in knowing your background with homeschooling. In an interview with National Review, you told the story of how your experience with your son in kindergarten led to your views. So could you tell our readers that story now?
Well, certainly. My son, I put him into public school for kindergarten, and he failed kindergarten. His teacher told me that he needed one more year, and of course I believed her, so I put him in for one more year of kindergarten. He felt like a failure.
Uh-huh.
He didn't enjoy his experience at all that second year, and by that time I had a six-year-old dropout. So as an educator, I have my degree in art, but I have a secondary education credential for substituting, and have done quite a bit of teaching, and by that time I had done teaching of adults and quite a bit of teaching in the public system as well as a substitutor. So I felt that I could homeschool him. But a judge said that even though the law was that we could homeschool in Nevada, it should say that you could not homeschool unless you lived more than 50 miles away from the nearest school.
Okay.
I, with a group of others, went to our Nevada State Capitol with a bill to allow us to homeschool. It was quite an experience. I didn't testify at that hearing, but I was there to listen. And at the end of the hearing, the committee chairman came toward me and said, if I had known that there would be 500 people here instead of 50, and that it would last for 4 hours instead of 30 minutes, I would have thrown this bill in my drawer, and it would have never seen the light of day.
Oh, wow.
I turned to an Elko cowboy at that moment and said, can he do that? And he said, well, yes. He has given us the hearing, though, and we will get a vote, and so we've done very well today. At that point, I started a private school so that we could change the law, but also so that I could have my children where we could teach them. And I did that for 2 years, taught in a one-room school. We had 14 kids the first year, 24 the second. I was the lead teacher and administrator in that school, and it was a K through 12 school. We did graduate two seniors the second year.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, then after the second year, we did have a homeschooling law that allowed us to homeschool. So I took my children home and homeschooled them for two more years. I put my son and daughter back into public school. My son then graduated salutatorian of his class, got his degree in education, his master's in land use planning, and is now a history teacher in eighth grade history in Yerington, Nevada. So that was my first encounter with a law that I felt needed to be changed. And when we got our homeschooling law, it was quite regulatory. Required that we have testing in the public school once a year and prove that our children were advancing 1 year in a year's time, which the public schools didn't even require of public school teachers.
Uh-huh.
It also required that we submit our curriculum to the school board once a year with a 180-day already planned out schedule of 6-hour days, 5 days a week, and covering our subjects with some detail on how we were going to teach this for approval. We had to petition the school board. We had to hire a supervisory certified teacher. Even though I had a teaching certificate, I had to hire another certified teacher to come in and supervise me once a week and say that I was homeschooling my children. And the list of things just went on from there.
That's really
so
very restrictive.
For the next 30 years, then the homeschooling community worked to deregulate this. And at the end of my political stay, my career as an assemblywoman, I had 10 bills that I could introduce.
Uh-huh.
And so I requested a homeschooling bill at that time, and then as a citizen unpaid lobbying for the lobbyist for the homeschoolers, we passed the most freeing homeschool law in the United States. And really what it says is you can homeschool in the state of Nevada, which was what the law said in the first place 30 years ago before I went through the whole process.
So it was quite an achievement then.
Well, I feel like it's one of the things that I was able to do as a state legislator that really helps families, helps
mm-hmm.
Parents, and helps kids.
Do you, in fact, as has been said, favor abolishing the Department of Education, and if so, why?
Well, what I've always said, now, the TV ads say abolishing. I don't believe that I've ever used that word exactly, but what I have proposed is that when they ask conservatives what they're going to cut,
mm-hmm.
I have proposed that we need to cut those agencies and programs that are not specifically covered by the federal government in the Constitution that would be better covered at the state level. And so the Department of Education at the federal level is a policy-making department that passes down one-size-fits-all policy that fits no one. It's generally
mm-hmm.
unfunded or underfunded mandate to the states. And truthfully, the states would be better creating their own policies and keeping their money at home, using it as close to the local level as possible in those classrooms where parents and teachers are the main stakeholders. And so when we talk about which agencies should eventually be disbanded, I believe that Reagan and I agree, and many others. This is not a new idea with me. It's just that we all understand that government's not the solution, it's the problem, and certainly the Department of Education provides no solutions.
Okay, how would you summarize your view of what you think the government's role in education should be?
The way that our laws are written, there has been a feeling that, well, I guess for over 100 years now, that the government should be involved in providing free public education,
mm-hmm.
and by that using our tax dollars to educate children. The role then becomes one of policy making that sometimes becomes so onerous that it actually puts into play a cookie cutter setting where, you know, every child needs to be the same or they drop off on both sides of the spectrum, generally those with special needs and those that are high achievers, their needs are not met as well by this system. And so I believe that education should be, as I said, as close to the local level, those policies created there with parents and teachers being the stakeholders that decide the policy within the school, not administrators and departments and agencies that rarely see a child.
Okay. How would you describe the fundamental difference in your view of the role of government in people's lives and Harry Reid's view of that role?
I'm a lower taxes, less government regulation person. I believe that is a fairly mainstream conservative stand, and I believe it's a mainstream American stand as well. Harry Reid has undertaken many progressive left-wing policies that put more power at the federal level, put more power within the government, and actually have begun to mandate to the people what they will do and what they will not do. Obamacare is just a perfect example of that kind of mandate where people are forced to participate in insurance programs that they don't necessarily want nor need. And that seems to me to be a very over-regulating and overburdening role of government, and not at all what the free market society that we live in espouses.
Okay, would you support then the constitutional challenges on that health care mandate that are now progressing through the courts?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think Nevadans generally at heart don't want to lose the advantages of Harry Reid's seniority, and what could Nevada in fact lose if you defeat Harry Reid?
I believe that Nevadans no longer believe that Harry Reid has done more for Nevada. In fact, most Nevadans believe that Harry Reid has forgotten about Nevada. You only need to look at the way that our dollars are spent, and that those dollars are not spent in Nevada. In fact, when we were talking about education dollars from the federal level, we're 44th in the United States in receiving our dollars back. So it would be much better if we were able to keep our dollars here. And most Nevadans truly understand that our dollars would be much better spent in the state rather than letting Harry Reid filter them out to his friends in a let's make a deal framework of what Harry Reid has been doing for over 20 years now in the United States Senate. They don't perceive him as doing more for Nevada. In fact, they perceive him as having done, as being responsible, actually, for the highest foreclosure rate in the nation, the highest bankruptcy rate in the nation, and the highest rate of unemployment. And
that's
so
in the case
that's their feeling, is that he has not done more. We can't really afford him.
Okay. Real Clear Politics has a race analysis for Nevada. It says it's a toss-up now, and says that, quote, you are running as a proud Christian conservative in Sin City. They're seeing that as a negative for your campaign, and what's your response to that?
Well, I have to tell you, I've never seen a campaign quite like this one in my history anyway, and in my studies of history of campaigns. It's really amazing to me how truly, it's just interesting that they're focused. I've run over 9 campaigns, and this is the first one that is focused on my faith. Harry Reid also has a faith. He's a Mormon, and yet the press does not call him a proud Mormon in Sin City.
True.
And so I think it's kind of interesting that my religion is seen as a negative, and yet his is seen as not even existent.
Yeah.
And yet he's made some fairly poignant remarks about how he doesn't do policy without first consulting his faith. So it's an interesting observation that they make, and I think that I'm not denying, of course, my faith, and I wouldn't do that, but I'm not sure that that's what Nevadans are interested in. They're interested in, as I said, our economy, our jobs, and our homes, and Harry Reid is pulling out all the stops as far as any other issue, trying to make this race about me. And, of course, that's what's tightened the race, is that he has been, since the moment I won the primary, on the television and radio with the most outrageous smear campaign that anyone has ever seen. It is quite vitriolic and accusatory and fairly mean, mean spirited, and we have, of course, had to let him have the airwaves for almost a month while we marshaled our finances, and that put me down in the polls quite a lot. and because I wasn't responding. But once we started to respond, we've not only brought those polling numbers back up to even, but we're slowly inching ahead. And I think that as we continue to speak the truth and get the issues out that Nevadans are interested in talking about, that margin will widen.
Okay. So what are your predictions for the 2010 elections, and what strategies do you think the GOP should use to win back the House and the Senate?
The predictions. I'm not much of a predictor.
Okay.
I kind of am running this campaign one day at a time,
uh-huh.
and I'm depending upon the people, which I think the GOP should as well. People are generally very much informed these days. I've watched in the last 18 months people get involved in politics that have never even voted before. They're now registering to vote, and they're saying, what can I do? We have them coming into, we have four offices in the state plus the offices in the counties, the GOP offices, and they all tell the same story. People are coming in, getting registered, some changing their registration from Democrat and Independent just to get involved in this race and wanting to volunteer, to make phone calls, to walk. I think that the policies of Obama, Reid, and Pelosi have stirred the silent majority, sleeping giant, as it were. These folks, I believe, are mainstream America. They have gotten an education in politics in the last 18 months, and they are desperate to go back to constitutional principles. And so I believe that that's really how the strategy is. It's simple. It's a simple strategy of sticking to constitutional principles, of talking to the people, not talking down to them, and listening to the people, not being disconnected from them. These are all the arrogant posturing that has gone on in Washington, D.C. for the last 18 months, where those who are presiding, the Democrats who come back to the state, Harry Reid chief among them, will not even hold town hall meetings on Obamacare,
right.
on the health care situation in 2009. They were avoiding the people.
Mm-hmm.
And truly, that has angered the people. And when they refused to take their phone calls because they didn't have the right zip code or the right area code, once again, they just infuriated the people and made the people more resolved to take the matter into their hands and make this, once again, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And I would say that we, the people, are speaking now loudly and clearly, and that's what you can see in these races across the country.
Okay, if you were elected to the Senate, would you back an outright repeal of Obamacare, and or would you favor defunding it?
I would back an outright repeal, and I would favor defunding it.
Okay. You favor place...
Whatever it takes to remove this.
Yeah, really, really. So, I noticed in your campaign literature that you favor placing limits on malpractice lawsuits, and as I recall, George Bush the Elder proposed this years ago, but somehow the idea seems to have gotten lost. Why do you think that isn't more popular?
I believe it's because the states have taken it on as a 10th Amendment right. Nevada already has a medical malpractice limitation of $350,000.
Uh-huh.
California has one at $250,000. Texas has one. Many of the states have seen this as a, and rightly so, I believe, as their 10th Amendment right to form these tort reform laws within their states. I believe that this is just part of what true health care insurance reform, and I say that to you very specifically, that this is health care insurance reform,
uh-huh.
because our health care system is the best in the world. We provide the best health care. The system itself of doctors and nurses and hospitals and just the providing of care is excellent. The
mm-hmm.
problem, of course, is the cost of that care, and it lays strongly at affordable insurance, and many of the solutions to those cost problems are ignored. In fact, all of the free market solutions are ignored in the Obamacare bill. They don't talk about tort reform. They don't talk about going across state lines. They don't talk about taking off mandated coverages that every time one is placed in legislation and required raises the cost of insurance. They don't talk about expanding insurance pools and insurance risks so that pre-existing conditions can be covered. They don't, they just don't talk about health care savings accounts where people can have a catastrophic coverage and then pay for the coverages that are within their means with that health care account or add to their insurance the coverages that they need rather than the government says they have to have. So to me, those free market solutions will provide a competitive market for insurance and also a cost-effective insurance policy throughout the nation, but the beginning steps are being taken by states.
Okay. I think the Tea Party has arisen in large part in reaction to Obamacare, and how would you assess the likely impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming elections?
Well, once again, I go back to that previous answer that I gave you about mainstream America being awakened in the last 18 months. And I think that, you know, the attempt of the progressives to pigeonhole or put the movement in a box and call it a Tea Party organization is ignoring the fact that this is a movement of mainstream voters, of mainstream America, and they can call it whatever they like, but what I see is mainstream Americans, and they are ready to vote. They have been voting, and when they call certain of us, I know Rand Paul and Ken Buck and I have been called the Tea Party candidates, which I wear as a badge of honor, truthfully, because it is mainstream America that is backing us as candidates. We represent the people of America, and proudly so.
Okay. Pro-life is another big issue with our readers, and if you're elected to the U.S. Senate, what criteria will you use in deciding how to vote on judicial nominees, as there seems to be a lot of controversy over litmus tests and so forth?
Well, certainly I believe that Supreme Court justices should be strict constitutional interpreters. They need to abide by the Constitution, and especially those founding documents. The Declaration of Independence says we all have the right, an inalienable right to life.
Right.
And so in looking at those documents, I believe that I will be voting for justices who strictly interpret the meanings of our founders' documents. And I think that clearly within the founders' documents, you can see that they valued life at all levels, not just the unborn, but the aged as well. Yeah, and we are seeing through policies like Obamacare that even our disabled and our elderly have a cause to be concerned about the government's attitude toward the value of their life and the quality of their life. I know that this issue didn't come into any kind of political arena until after a Supreme Court made a legislative move from the bench, which is completely unconstitutional as far as I can see. The Constitution does not give judges the right to legislate from the bench, and yet they created a law through case law, Roe v. Wade, that certainly all of us now are having to live with, whether we agree with it or not, and had absolutely no say-so because we didn't elect these judges. We elected representatives to the Congress and to the Senate. And certainly that's where those kinds of laws should be made, not in a court.
Well, I think we would all agree with that. How would you have voted on the Elena Kagan nomination had you been in the Senate at the time?
I would have opposed her nomination.
Okay. Also, do you favor cutting off all federal funding for abortion?
Yes.
Okay. And more broadly, how do you think legalized abortion can be overturned in the United States through the courts, through legislation, or what?
Well, since it was a case law that established Roe v. Wade, it is a court decision that will have to overturn it, I believe. I don't know that there is a way legislatively to overturn case law. I haven't. I know that we have fought against court decisions here in Nevada. I did this specifically in 2003 when we had a constitutional amendment that said we needed to pass taxes by a two-thirds majority, and the courts decided that that a tax could be passed by a simple majority. I took that case law all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to have it overturned. It, in fact, was not because they one of our members who was fighting this went ahead and voted for the tax, so they got their two-thirds majority, and the Supreme Court would not hear it because they said it was no harm, no foul, since they had got their two-thirds majority in the end. Even though they had passed an illegal bill, there was no harm. But what happened was we have elected judges in our state, and those that had made that unpopular decision with the people were turned out, and the new court then reversed their decision and made our Constitution whole once more. So that's my experience with case law, is that when it's in the court, then the court must overturn their own decision or reverse their own decision.
Okay, and I think for your stand, then, you did receive the Ronald Reagan Freedom Medal.
Yes, I did.
In 2004.
Yeah, it was called the Ronald Reagan Freedom Medallion. That's what it was called.
Yeah, I think it's the Ronald Reagan Freedom Medallion for a Courageous
Yes.
Client.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You favor permanently repealing the federal estate tax, and what's led you to take that stand?
Truly, our economy is in such dire straits, and I've talked to businessmen across our state. And just for example, there is a business here in Reno where it is a family-owned business. The father is 82. They hire 33 employees. If the father were to die and the estate tax were not permanently repealed, if it was allowed to expire, they would be taxed 55% of their business. All 33 of those employees would lose their job, and they would probably lose the business as well. 55%
uh-huh.
is just devastating to any business, and so that is really what is happening in our United States. That's just one example, but there are many, many examples of family-owned businesses, and that was the reason that they put the tax cut in place in the first place. Not only that, but of course, we know that those revenues, that income had already been taxed once before it went into that estate. It was taxed at the time that it was earned. And so it seems completely unconstitutional to me to double tax income.
Right, right. So do you favor privatizing Social Security, and if so, how?
The Social Security system is $2.5 trillion in debt. There are IOUs there, not real funds. Those funds have been allowed to go into the general fund to be used to make deals, to finance programs and policies, everything but Social Security. And because of that, the $2.5 trillion is missing, and now we're in a situation where $41 billion less is coming into the system than going out. And so they're going to have to go into more deficit to pay for those who are on Social Security. That money should be put back. That belongs to seniors. They put in. We need to fulfill our promise to them. Mm-hmm. But going forward, we also need to make sure that the government can never raid that Social Security fund again. And we need to give options to younger workers to have personalized accounts. I used to think that was only offered in the private sector, but of course, personalized accounts, retirement accounts are also offered to public employees. So, when I said that it should be privatized, I thought that was the only way that we could offer these personalized accounts. But I've seen that personalized accounts can be offered in all sectors, employee sectors. And that's what we need to do, is make sure that the government is never allowed to rob our retirement accounts again.
Okay. On another controverted area, immigration, do you support the Arizona law SB 1070, and if so, why?
I support the securing of our borders,
mm-hmm.
the enforcing of laws, and I support the right of Arizona to take its 10th Amendment and protect its citizens when the government has failed to protect them and secure their borders. I also support every state's right to deal with the safety of their citizens, and that's exactly what Arizona has done.
Okay, just last Friday, Governor Jan Brewer protested the State Department's, including the federal government's, opposition to SB 1070 in its report to the Human Rights Commissioner efforts. Your comments on this?
Oh, well, I think that it's outrageous for the federal government to sue the state over their law. Certainly, we're all waiting to see how the courts will decide, because in talking with my constitutional attorney friend, Dr. John Eastman, who helped me with that case in 2003, he has told me that they can't throw the case out. They have to make some decisions, and part of that law will survive. And, of course, all the rest of the states, I believe, are waiting to
mm-hmm.
see what parts of that bill do survive. I know that Assemblyman Don Gustafson, who's running for state senate here in Nevada, has already requested a bill similar to Arizona's law, just waiting to see how that will come out of the courts.
Okay. Polls show that most Americans are against having the mosque near Ground Zero, but most also think that those wishing to build it do have a right to do so. Would that be your position as well?
Well, certainly private property rights are paramount in American constitutional life. We all have the right to
mm-hmm.
own property, and we should have the right to develop that property as we please. However, with rights come responsibility. You know, I give up my rights often. I just a simple example, I have the right, because I signed up early and got my little pass to go on Southwest Air to be in the A line. But oftentimes I will give up my place in the line for our military. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And that's what my position is, that with rights come responsibility to do the right thing. And because of the because of what took place at Ground Zero, because of the involvement of the American people, not only just spiritually, emotionally, physically, just the complete symbol that the Ground Zero has for us in this nation, out of deference to that, they should give up their right and be responsible to do the right thing for the American people.
Okay, I think that's a stand a lot of people would agree with. Also, Senator Roland Burris of Illinois has introduced an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill that would repeal the ban on abortions performed in military hospitals overseas, and the Senate Armed Services Committee voted in favor of that amendment. So if that amendment does stay in the Defense Authorization Act, what do you think the consequences will be?
Well, I think it goes back to our first question on abortion, and that
mm-hmm.
is that I oppose federal funding of abortion,
uh-huh.
and so that would, of course, come under that situation. We shouldn't be federally funding abortions.
Okay. I think the House and Senate versions of the Defense Authorization Bill also include a repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and what are your thoughts on that?
I believe that should stay in place for our military's morale. It was put there for a reason, and military people asked for that because of the problems with discipline and things like that a different policy would engender. And so I believe that we should, when it comes to the morale of our military men, we should listen to them.
Okay. Finally, just a couple of concluding questions. Who would you say are your political heroes?
Well, of course, Ronald Reagan.
Uh-huh.
You can't do much better than that. When 80% of the people agreed with Ronald Reagan, and he put us on a road after a recession to prosperity that has lasted for decades. And of course, he had the right idea when it comes to how to make us the shining city on the hill, not only financially but militarily and in many other ways. He was just a wonderful example to us. I believe now when I look at the Senate, I look at Senator Jim DeMint, a very strong advocate for the Constitution, a strong advocate for freedom, and just a stellar example of a true people's representative.
Okay. How do you view the value of interfaith cooperation and social issues like pro-life and homeschooling?
I think that as Americans, we have always valued the First Amendment, which gives us the freedom of religion, not the freedom
uh-huh.
from religion.
Okay.
And so I think we value all faiths. We value the right to worship as we please, and we also value the opportunity to come together as a faith community to support those things that we all commonly believe and feel are necessary for a society to survive. We, you know, when you read the founders, I believe it was George Washington who said that our society, our form of government, our constitutional republic was wholly inadequate to govern any but a religious and moral people, because they saw in our future a self-governing people. And, of course, faith plays a big role in self-governing. As you know, the Bible says that one of the fruit of the Spirit is self-control.
Right.
So I think that we, as Americans, have always valued our own religious freedom as well as our own personal freedoms, and faith seems to play a great role in securing those blessings of freedom.
Okay, well, actually, those were all the questions I had, unless there's something you'd like to add.
No, I can't think of anything.
Okay, well, you gave us quite a bit of time.
You might add this.
Okay.
Harry Reid says he needs $25 million. I need a million people with $25 to go to SharonEngle.com. just a little advertisement
to put
there.
That in.
But if anyone would like to help me, I'm getting help from all over the United States, from people who feel the same way about government that I do and are willing to help us defeat Harry Reid.
Okay, it looks like you're doing pretty well with your fundraising, but obviously you need a lot more.
That's right. That's right. That's why I said if you could put a little commercial in, that'd be great.
Well, we'll include this with the recording.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, goodbye.
Bye-bye.